This is Evolutionary Radio. I am so excited about today's episode, I'm skipping our normal intro. I have Steve joining me as always, and we have peptide expert Alex Kickle from theprepcoach.com. Alex, thank you so much for doing this Q&A episode.
Definitely, man. Thanks to both of you guys for having me back on. I love the last time we did it, and just excited for today.
So a lot of people are interested in peptides. They don't even know where to start. Steve's going to kind of give you the whole peptide list, and you can just give us kind of like a brief 2-minute segment on each peptide, what it does, what it's good for. So Steve, do you want to start rattling them off?
Well, really quick, I want to ask you, Alex, peptides, are most of these peptides stuff already in our body? And when we take peptides, we're pretty much adding more. Is that pretty much close to it in the simple terms?
Exactly. Yeah. So whenever we're looking at this, although it's coming from an exogenous source, we're getting basically our bodies to produce everything endogenously. So if you're looking at a growth hormone peptide, for example, you're trying to take advantage of your own growth hormone production. So you're basically either creating a pulse or amplifying that pulse. And a lot of the things, like you said, even like the healing peptides, a lot of them, you know, basically upregulate actin, which is already within our body. So it's just getting our bodies to work a little bit better and kind of move from that physiological range to a little bit more in that super physiological range.
And they add to our existing, they don't suppress us like hormones do and replace, they add, correct?
Depending on the dosage, depending on the actual, depending on the actual peptide, actually, like a lot of them will cause desensitization a little bit quicker than others. Depending on if someone's using them for a lot longer period of time, then you can run into suppressive issues. So that's generally one of the reasons why people cycle them in and out.
Okay, good, good. So let's get into the first one, which is not a GHRP, not even in the same league, but melanotan-2. And that's that is the tanning peptide.
Dude, it's melanotan.
Melanotan, yeah. But I don't know how to pronounce.
Dude, if you said that in one of my chemistry labs, you would have gotten freaking eaten.
Everyone calls it that, though, in my gym. But we don't need to use that much here in South Florida. But Trevor, up where Trevor lives, he's got to use it up there in Canada. So tell us a little bit about this and how do we use it?
So if you look at its origin, it was actually synthesized in the Department of Pharmacology, and I believe it was somewhere like the University of Arizona. And they were basically looking for different ways to help people battle skin cancer and so reduce the rates of, you know, people getting harmed from all these different ultraviolet rays. So that's kind of why it was brought to the market. Now, obviously, being bodybuilders, everyone's trying to look tanner year round so that you basically look better. So it's really a cosmetic thing. If you use it at a higher dosage, you do have some potential to actually increase insulin sensitivity. People have talked about that before, but generally it's not something that I would personally use for that reason. It's another injection that, you know, you really don't need. But it basically works by actually speeding up the process. You know, so the natural tanning process known as, melanogenesis, right? That sounds about right. So it's basically your melanocytes gives your skin cells the ability to basically produce more melanin. So that's why it can actually change the pigments.
Libido? Yeah. Because a lot of people are also using melanotan for libido.
Say that again?
What about for like increases in libido?
Yeah, so if you look at that, that's another one that's very person dependent on the dosage. I've seen some people dosing something like, you know, a very low dosage of 5 milligrams, which a lot of people, you know, will go way above that, and immediately they have libido, their libido goes skyrockets through the roof. Other people, they need way on the farther end of the spectrum. They need like 50 to 60 milligrams. So that's another one that I feel is really dependent on the person. And generally, if their libido is lacking or it's not up to par, it's generally for some other hormonal issue going on. And obviously, being bodybuilders, it's usually a different exogenous hormone that's causing those issues.
So what's the dosing protocol for this? Is it 500 micrograms per day until you reach your tan, then dropping it to 2 or 3 times a week? Is that the standard?
So yeah, you can do it that way. You always want to look at the total dosage that you want to work up to. And remember, everyone listening, this is not all in one shot, because I've had people do that and they get extremely sick. It's not going to be something that you want to take all at one time. They actually have it broken down by your skin type. So if you're extremely fair skin and you rarely, like barely ever get a tan, you're looking at working up to a total dosage of about 30 milligrams. If you're kind of fair skin, you tan most of the time. Generally, I found 25 to 20 works pretty well. If you tan pretty easily, you can probably get away with 15 milligrams total. And if you're someone like myself, who I always have all the skin just from my, from my grandparents coming from Italy, and I very rarely burn, then you only need maybe 5 to 10 milligrams total. And you can work up to that. You can do loading phases. You can do it a couple different ways, but I would prefer the method that you said is just slowly incrementally working up. So starting off with maybe 500 micrograms per day and slowly building up until you're at that point.
And then I've read about, is there people with freckles having darkening freckles? What are the side effects and things that people need to be worried about? Like in tanning, going to a tanning bed and going outside in the sun obviously increases our chances of cancer, but this will not, correct?
Exactly. Yeah. So like I said, this was brought brought to the market to kind of get people away from having to use tanning beds and getting people away from having to go out into the sun so often. It's kind of interesting to me, and I've only done a little bit of research into the tanning beds, but it's one of those things where it just can't be good for you. I don't feel like any tanning bed is ever going to be, something that's going to have any kind of health benefit. It's only going to take away from your health, but, everything in moderation. So if you are looking at melanotan too, for example, some of the side effects, the biggest one people get is nausea. If they usually take too much of a dosage, they're generally going to get nauseous. In terms of long-term results, though, there really isn't any detrimental side effect, at least not that I've really seen and not that I've seen anything hold up in the literature. There's obviously the stray cases here and there, but nothing crazy, nothing that you would really even warrant a concern for. But like everything else, I wouldn't advise someone being on this year-round or using a really high dosage. That's why I don't like people using it for insulin sensitivity. Because yes, it will work. It can drop your blood glucose levels. I'm not sure by which mechanism, but it works fairly well for that. But there's other ways you can accomplish that goal without potentially using something that can make you extremely nauseous for days on end.
Okay, I got one more question, Alex, and then we'll let Steve introduce the next peptide. So I've never used melanotan, but what I'm curious about is, like, let's say you use it and then you get to the desired darkness you're looking for, right? Like, let's say you get the tan you're looking for. How long will that tan last?
So generally for that, a lot of people fall in the 2 to 3 month range. You have some people where it kind of sucks, but they're just kind of poor responders or poor metabolizers of melanotan too. And it generally has to do with their skin type. And they're only lasting about a month. So you're generally good for, you only have to do this protocol maybe every fourth month if you're a good responder to it.
Okay, that's good. That sums it up perfectly. The next one I want to get into, again, before we get into the GHRPs, is TB500. And this is one that I've personally been using myself. And we can thank euro-peptides.net for that. They sent me a bunch of this to use because I have chronic neck and arm issues from some nagging injuries that I've had over the years. So tell us a little bit about this one. It comes usually a 2 milligram or a 5 milligram vial, I believe. And tell us a little bit about this one. What's the deal with this one? What does it do and what can it do for us?
So with TB500, first of all, for everyone out there listening, anytime someone talks about TB500, you're generally going to hear BPC-157 as well. They're the two most common and most talked about, healing peptides. So looking at TB500 specifically, this is one that's obviously its primary purpose is looking at thymosin beta 4. So it's basically upregulating the cell building proteins like actin and all that kind of fun stuff. It does a really good job at reducing inflammation of your joints. It helps with tendonitis. If you look in terms of muscle spasms and cramping, it does a pretty good job at actually reducing those. I've seen some people, this is another one that has a potential to actually lower blood glucose levels, fasted, fed, pretty much all of the above. I actually had one guy who had actually lowered his HbA1c pretty dramatically, but that was obviously only one case. If you look a little bit on the cellular level of TB500, it really helps by regenerating stem cells, which is really what helps from its whole wound healing aspect of things. So you're going to have enhanced recovery rates. especially from a soft tissue aspect. Now, the one thing with TB500 is that it does go systemic. So remember when I talked about BPC-157, they say basically one systemic and one, you know, is only localized. They're both going to go systemic to a point. With TB500, I have not found it to be the case that it matters where you inject it. It's only going to matter that you basically get it into your system, whereas BPC-157 works a little bit better if you're putting it closer to the injured site. And I feel like that just has to do with, you know, obviously as it's moving through your body, it's losing a little potency, but I could be wrong on that. So that's really, you know, with TB500, that's probably a little.
So TB500 is like the one we just discussed, and you just stick it in your stomach. You don't have to stick it where it actually hurts.
Exactly, yeah.
So it won't make a difference. And what's the dosage on TB500? Is it the same thing? You load it up and then daily, and then after a couple of weeks, kind of drop off?
So this is something that I'd personally run for about 4 to 6 weeks. With any healing peptide, you need time for it to work. It's not going to be a week or two thing. I mean, you'll generally feel the effects after about a week or two, but right around week 3 and 4 is when you really feel the benefits. Now, if you look at a lot of the literature, and I've used TB500 now with at least, oh God, it's got to be over 150 or 200 clients. And so I wanted to actually take the actual recommended dosage that was broken down by the manufacturer. So if you look at MedVet, they actually have the dosage for Greyhounds. And that was broken down to about, I believe it's 0.0383 mgs per pound of body weight. It was basically how it would work out to be a human. So if you were 200 pounds, you're looking at about 7.6 milligrams. Now that's going to be split twice weekly. I found that dosage to work extremely well with a lot of people. Obviously that's a pretty hefty dosage. Again, especially whenever you said that generally it comes in about, you know, 2 mg vials. So you're going to be going through this pretty fast, but it is extremely effective. And especially you'll be able to tell if it's good TB500 or not, because if you're not feeling anything by week 2, then it most likely might've been damaged in the actual transporting process, or it was just never real TB500 to begin with.
I know Trevor wants to jump in, but how long? You said 4 to 6 weeks, but can you keep running it after that? And what kind of long-term negative side effects does this stuff have?
So long-term wise, and this kind of goes for everything that we're talking about today, we really don't know. We haven't been using these peptides. We haven't been using all these different, you know, synthetic, you know, compounds for long enough for us to really say, hey, this is what's going to happen. It's not like anabolic steroids where we know, hey, 30, 40, 50, 60 years down the line, this is what's going to happen. So we really don't know with TB500. That's why, again, anything peptide-wise, I just don't believe people should be running extremely long-term, except for maybe like an MK677, but that's a topic for another day. So I would say after that 4 to 6 week period, you should stop, and you should really only use it whenever your injured sites start acting up again.
Alex, one question I commonly get asked by any of my clients who are suffering from an injury is TB500 versus BPC-157, which one is better and which one do you recommend?
So, man, I generally, with the vast majority of people, I find them responding a lot better to BPC-157. I have no reasoning for that other than what I've seen with, you know, a couple hundred of clients over the years. It's one of those things where, for whatever reason, BPC-157 just seems to heal better and heal longer. So people that say have tennis elbow or nagging injuries in their knees, it seems to clear up those issues fairly quickly within the first 2 to 3 weeks, just like TB500. But even furthermore, it doesn't seem to come back as quickly. And these are, you know, keeping, you know, basically everything controlled as much as possible.
Interesting. What I've found is that, let's say it's like a ex-pro hockey player, right? And he has a bad shoulder, his lower back is tweaked, he's got a bad knee, he's got multiple injuries. I find TB500 works better because it's more systemic. But I find if it's a specific injury, like it's just their elbow or it's just their shoulder, BPC-157 seems to work better.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. And it makes sense by how they're metabolized, you know, and no matter what, I mean, anything you're putting in your body, it's going to go systemic to a point. But like I said, and then like you just said with BPC-157, it just seems to work better near the injured site. And like I said, I've looked, but there's just not enough research and we don't know enough about how it works to really, you know, tell us, hey, this is exactly why it works that way.
So the next one, PT-141, I was reading about this for sexual dysfunction. Do you know much about this one?
A little bit. You know, it's funny because there's going to be a lot of these different peptides that, you know, have some benefit, but honestly, with PT, I'm not really a big fan. You know, if you look at it in terms of how it works for erectile dysfunction standpoint, it does work fairly well. You know, generally you're going to see it online. I think it's generally like 10 milligram vials whenever you go to buy it. But the studies that actually look at it show that it doesn't really act on the vascular system like a lot of those other kind of compounds that work by activating melanocortin receptors in the brain. So if you're looking at it from a sexual stimulation standpoint, it obviously does help, but I'm just not really a big fan. I see a lot of people developing a lot of side effects from it. People getting, again, the nausea, people obviously, you know, healing their dysfunction, but then having other issues, mainly neurological. And I really don't have any kind of evidence to support that. It's just what I've seen over the years. So I've really gotten away from ever recommending that to people.
So the next one, the CJC1295, and then the one with DAC. Tell us a little bit about these.
Okay, so we are looking at, so first of all, let me take a step back just for everyone out there to make sure everyone's on the same page. Remember that there's different types of these growth hormone peptides. We have GHRPs and GHRHs. So your GHRPs are your growth hormone releasing peptides, which are your GHRP2, 6, hypomyelin, hexarelin, and they basically function to stimulate your pituitary to produce more growth hormone. Okay, so if you look at your GHRHs, that's your growth hormone releasing hormone, excuse me, and that's where your CJC1295 with or without DAC would come in. This is the one that's going to release a series of pulses over a longer period of time. So you were asking about CJC with DAC or without, or both?
Yeah, what is the difference between both, and how do you, would you use both? Because they both usually come in 2 milligrams, but the DAC is almost twice as more expensive. So why is that?
So that DAC, it actually stands for drug affinity complex. That was actually added to CJC to basically allow people to utilize it without having to inject themselves so often, so that you can get multiple growth hormone pulses throughout the day without constantly having to inject yourself every couple hours. That was once thought as kind of, you know, the growth hormone bleeding effect, which we could talk about later on if you guys want to, but it basically extended the half-life. It extended it to about a week or so. I think it's actually about 10 or 14 days. And it basically provided, obviously, you know, steadier blood levels after you injected it. So whenever you look at, you know, the DAC, whenever it's added, it actually binds to the albumin that circulates your body. So literally it's being able to last for days as it's looking for receptors to bind to. So if you prefer to kind of keep things more along the line of the natural, our peaks and valleys in our growth hormone pulses, you're more looking at using CJC without DAC because you can create those short spikes. But if you are looking to, at least if you don't care about that, if you don't care about the health side of things and you are looking to use CJC with DAC, then you can provide steadier blood levels. You can essentially be anabolic and lipolytic for a longer period of time and get a lot more, we'll say, physical benefits out of it. But remember, you are going against what your body wants to do. So if you think about it, you know, kind of like I said, and our natural patterns are peaks and valleys, you're going to have a strong flat line. And that's really what the bleed is. It doesn't really match our natural patterns. Now, people have to decide whether they, you know, what their goal is with everything. If they are doing this to become a competitive bodybuilder, if they're just doing this recreationally, and how much they want to risk their health, how long they plan on using the product. So they both definitely have their place. Personally, between the two, I would always use CJC with DAC, because it's one of the few things out there. It's kind of like MK677 in the fact that you can put on, you know, probably 5 to 10 pounds, a lot of it being fluid and just pure water weight at first, but the nitrogen retention you get intramuscularly is ridiculous. And your pumps for those first couple of weeks are going to be insane. So if you take advantage of that, you can grow very fast on either MK or CJC with DAC.
And what's the dosage going to be, dosage protocol, and how long? Is it the same thing? 6 weeks or?
So with CJC with DAC, now, first of all, timeline wise, there really is no timeline for any of these things. It's really going to depend on your budget. It's going to depend on how much you want to push things. You know, if you have a competitive bodybuilder, for example, in the off season, you know, he may be pushing 5 to 10 total milligrams per week, which is an extremely high amount. I had one guy who used CJC with DAC at, I believe, 10 milligrams and used 25 milligrams of NK, and he got his IGF scores in the low 600s. And that's a good, you know, 4 to 5 IUs of pharmaceutical grade growth hormone levels of IGF. So if you're at that level, then you might be pushing things harder and longer. Most people, if they're using CJC DAC, they're generally going to use anywhere from 1 to 3 milligrams per week. And they can get a lot of benefit out of that. I personally like to split it biweekly just because even though the half-life is about, you know, about 8 to, you know, even upwards of 14 days in some cases, depending on how people metabolize it, I still like make sure the blood levels are a little bit more stable. And if you split it that way, you're also not going to actually hold as much fluid. You know, you're not getting that massive influx of growth hormone at one time. So from that side of things, I would probably dose it there. But again, it's really going to depend on the person.
I agree with you completely, Alex, about splitting it up. It's kind of like if someone's using Test-E or Test-Sip, you know, theoretically, you only really need to inject it once per week, but you'll get much more stable blood hormone levels if you inject it twice per week.
Yeah, exactly. And people will, it's funny because you'll get in arguments with people online that talk about, oh, this drug was made to have this half-life for a reason. And then you look at TRT patients and how they actually are given their TRT and told to do it. And we are not talking about, you know, replacement levels. We are talking about going into that super physiological range as a bodybuilder. That's so things aren't the same. Things are different between, like you said, you know, TRT, which could be 150 to 200 milligrams a test, to 5 to maybe upwards of 1 gram a test, you know?
So Alex, with these CGC peptides, I know the CGC without DAC, you'll get a lot more benefit by stacking it with a GHRP, like GHRP2, GHRP6. The CJC with DAC, do you need to stack that with a GHRP, or can you just run that by itself?
So you can actually run that by itself. That's why it's really favored by a lot of people, because if you look at anyone's going to be using these peptides, they're generally going to have a 9-to-5 job. I don't know many people that can get away with sticking themselves, you know, 3 to 5 times throughout the day, like in an office wise. So with CJC with DAC, you do it 2 times per week. I have someone do it probably first thing upon waking with a very basic somatostatin inhibitor, just to help from that standpoint. Even though, at least with a longer acting, you know, compound like CJC with DAC, may not be as beneficial, but I would pair it with something like an EGCG. That's kind of one of my more favorite somatostatin inhibitors because it does a really good job at actually sensitizing the growth hormone receptor itself. So you can get a little bit better benefit out of any of your peptides if you utilize that with it. So I would definitely, you know, obviously recommend that. But if you're someone who, you know, you work for yourself, you work from home, or you have the ability to do it, people have done the combinations of GHRP and GHRH is, you know, 3 to even upwards of 6 times per day. And that's really a bitch to try and time, because remember, with these growth hormone peptides, they need to be utilized in a fasted state because you're trying to produce your own endogenous production. It's not exogenous growth hormone where you can basically shoot it with a meal, during a meal, after a meal. It doesn't matter. That's the actual hormone. This is getting your body to produce its own growth hormone and stimulate your pituitary. That needs to be done in at least the most fastest state possible.
So the best time would be to inject it upon waking if you're going to have breakfast before you eat?
Yeah. So the general recommendations I would have people do is, you know, wake up, you know, basically take your growth hormone peptides. If you are having exogenous growth hormone with that, I would wait 15 minutes and then take your exogenous growth hormone. That is done so you can basically ride out that pulse and wave of growth hormone levels. And that was actually taught to me by, I'm sure you guys have heard of him, That Be True. He was a legend online, basically the godfather of peptides. He was recently actually found. But either way, yeah, he had so many theories out there, and some of it was backed in science, some of it wasn't, but a lot of those theories are what I've applied over the years, and I've kind of learned from them and tweaked them. So I'd have someone do that, you know, and then if you're eating every 3 hours, I would take your peptide something like 15 minutes before a meal, wait your 15 minutes, and then eat your meal. So you're getting at least 2 hours and 45 minutes in between the actual meals where you can, you know, potentially drop back down your glucose levels to be in a more fasted state.
So we're getting into now GHRP2, GHRP6. They both usually are 5 milligram vials. They're both the same price. What is the difference?
So GHRP6, everyone calls it sloppy, and I think that's kind of for a good reason. This is one that's going to give you the most amount of side effects, but a pretty good intense amount of growth hormone, or at least release of growth hormone. So if you look at GHRP6, that's what's going to cause a lot of hunger and a lot of gastric motility. Does have some effect on cortisol and prolactin. So if you're using GHRP6, expect to experience more side effects. The only time I would have anyone use GHRP6 is if they're in the off season or any time that they need to eat. That's one thing that once you start working with these bigger guys that are 250 to 350 in the off season, hunger can become an issue. So GHRP6 is only added in for the hunger aspect. Whereas GHRP2, it's less sloppy. So you can get more of an intense or a little bit less of an intense growth hormone pulse, but you don't have the actual same negative side effects. So you're not going to be hungry all the time. There's some potential, again, for cortisol and prolactin, but not as much as GHRP6. And it's kind of the quote unquote, safer option.
And the dosing protocol for these?
So this one varies so dramatically. You look at people online talking about saturation points and dosages, and you see anywhere people recommend basically about 100 micrograms up to like 300, something in that range is generally what you see people recommend. I would have people start and keep it at 100. Generally, once you start working higher and higher up, you're not going to see much benefit. And that's generally, you're only going to experience the negative side effects. So if you're using GHRP6 for its hunger benefits, then you could get away with 200 to 300 micrograms at a time. But just know anything over that 100 microgram range really isn't going to help you from a growth hormone releasing standpoint.
What I've read in the literature is anything over 200 micrograms per dosage is a waste. So I agree with you.
Yeah. And even at that, like if you look at GHRP2, the difference between 100 micrograms and 200 micrograms at one time, especially if it's paired with the GHRH, it's something like, maybe like a 0.5% difference. And to me, that's nothing to me, but again, hunger wise, if you're using GHRP6, that can really, if you take 300 micrograms of GHRP6, you will literally eat everything in the house.
The next one is Hexorelin, I believe it's pronounced. Trevor's going to make fun of me for pronouncing it wrong. That one comes in 2 milligrams vials on our sponsor's website. But it's also not expensive. What's the difference between that one and the GHRP? Is that a GHRH? Or is this also a GHRP?
Yeah, so this is still a GHRP. Hexorelin is probably one of my favorite peptides out there. So if you look at it, and this, I've actually had a lot of conversations with Mike Arnold about this. It's just, if you could find a way to basically stop the desensitization process of occurring with hexorelin, then you'd be a millionaire. It is literally the strongest pulse of growth hormone that you can get from any growth hormone peptide. And that first injection of hexorelin, so you've never taken it before, you get it in, you take your first shot, it's going to raise your growth hormone levels faster and higher than even, we'll say 5 IUs of pharmaceutical grade growth hormone would. But the issue is, after that first shot, it desensitizes so quickly to where the second shot is already dramatically less. That doesn't mean it stops working, but it's not such an extremely high amount. That's why people say, again, if you could find a way to stop that from happening, which no one has yet, you would just, especially in the bodybuilding community, you would make so much money. So it is extremely strong. It does a really good job, and I would classify it as kind of a recomping peptide. Between that and IGF-LR3, those would be my two favorite in terms of recomping. They just do a really good job at giving you the ability to increase nutrient partitioning, to actually, work from a lipolytic and an anabolic standpoint because of that high amount of growth hormone. So whenever growth hormone is being raised to that extent, obviously IGF is going to be there. Now, IGF doesn't do much in terms of fat loss, but in terms of the overall nutrient partitioning effects, that's why a lot of people tend to lean out on hexorelin. It's not from the IGF part of it. It's from the actual, increase in nutrient partitioning.
So the IGF-1 LR3 is actually the one I was going to do next.
You missed one of the GHRPs.
I know. I'm going to backtrack, but he mentioned that. I'm trying to see between the hex and the IGF-1 LR3, what are the dosages on both of those? And then we'll move on.
So both of those, you can do these a couple different ways. For a lot of these, they're going to have almost the same saturation point at about 100 micrograms. So if you look at hexorelin, you could do 100 micrograms, 3 times per day. You can do it 1 time per day. You can do it 2 times per day. Hexorelin is going to basically, after you go through about one little vial of hex, I would stop. you know, you need to take, because it desensitizes so quickly that generally what I recommend for a lot of people is 4 weeks, you know, 3 to 4 weeks maximum on hexarelin. Some people can handle a little bit longer, but some people desensitize around week three. So you really have to take into account your own biofeedback. You really have to look and see, okay, am I still getting these insane pumps? Am I still leaning out? Like, if you would take hexarelin before bed, time and time again, I'll have people wake up the next morning, send me an email right away and say, holy shit, it looks like I lost 5 pounds of body fat overnight. They didn't really, but they tightened up and they're obviously more pumped and their muscle bellies are more full with more nitrogen retention. So it appears that way. As soon as you start losing that, that's generally a good sign that you're desensitized and you should probably drop hexarelin. So hexarelin is one you really have to keep an eye on. If you're comparing it to IGF-LR3, again, max, you're looking at 100 micrograms on IGF-LR3. But I've had a lot of people do really good at even 25 micrograms and just low dosing it. Because with IGF-LR3, remember, it's insulin-like growth factor. So it's acting like insulin. So if you look at the half-life because of how long it lasts, it's essentially circulating and binding to receptors 24/7. So you're going to be able to get a little bit of a longer benefit out of IGF-LR3. But even at that, 4 weeks is still about 4 to 5 weeks is generally where I would stop using either of these. Generally, because if you look at a lot of the different receptors in your gut, I don't want to say that they spill over, but at some point, some of the IGF receptors that are located intramuscularly, they almost become desensitized. And then where's it going to go? Okay, it's going to keep circulating around. It has to find a receptor somewhere, right? It finds the receptors in your gut. Generally, people will start bloating. So that's why you stop it right away. You won't get any bloating and you should be better off.
Anything you want to add, Trevor?
What are the differences on the two different types of IGF?
So IGF-DES and IGF-LR3. DES is basically the shorter version of the chain. It's something like 5 or 10 times more powerful. I can't remember specifically, but that half-life is really only 20 to 30 minutes. This is one where it basically binds to receptors that are basically deformed by different acids, metabolites that are present during your workout. So it actually allows DES to attach itself to that basically broken receptor and it starts signaling tissue growth during your training. So DES is awesome if you can use it literally right before you walk into the gym and start your workouts because the half-life is so short. Now, DES is one that's talking about, it has a potential for localized growth. So say you're trying to grow your biceps, it's supposed to stimulate hyperplasia better in those areas. But the caveat is it has to be microdosed. So if you have your biceps, if you're trying to grow your biceps, for example, using IGF-DES, you need to literally microdose it, you know, 10 to 20 pricks, small injections on each bicep, making sure you're getting each head. It has to be spread out, obviously, throughout the entire muscle so it can get to every receptor properly. Some people will see, and this is literally a 50-50 split in terms of people that I've had utilize it for that purpose. Half the people, you know, if they use it on, say, again, their biceps, they see their biceps just blow up. Other people, they see systemic growth, but not necessarily localized. And I feel like a lot of that has to do with the actual administration of the product. I don't know about you, but I don't want to sit there and jab myself 40 times and use, you know, 100 IUs of a solution just to get it to actually spread that much. So, you know, it depends on who you are and really what you want out of it. But IGF-DES and LR3, the biggest difference is really how long they're active. I personally like LR3 for the vast majority of people just because it's around longer. You get a little bit better of insulin benefits if you're going to be using it, say, in a post-workout setting. Pre-workout IGF-1 DES, I just don't see it's practical for a lot of people. A lot of people aren't going to be in the bathroom jabbing themselves with DES before a workout. So usually LR3 is kind of my go-to.
So I'm trying to stick to ABC order here. I don't know if that's okay with you, Trevor, because you're like complaining. But is there a next one you want to do, Trevor, or should I just keep going ABC order?
Just keep going, and then I'll do some questions for the rest of the show.
HGH frag was, we jumped to the I, but let's go back and finish the H. HGH frag comes in 5 milligram vial usually. And it's, tell us a little bit about this one. What's the difference between this one and the others? Any subtle differences?
Yeah. So one of the biggest subtle differences is actually, it's not even subtle at all. If you look at the structure of it, it's actually the lipolytic tail end of the growth hormone molecule. So HGH frag is really there to stimulate lipolysis, so actually breaking down fatty acids. This is one thing that, remember I talked about before, that you need to be fasted for a lot of these things to work. If you're fat and you take HGH frag, you might as well just throw it in the garbage. It's not going to be doing anything because of how it actually works to stimulate lipolysis. So whenever you look at its ability to regulate fat metabolism, it actually can increase insulin sensitivity. It's absolutely amazing. This would be something that I would use first thing upon waking before fasted cardio. I would stack this with, again, whatever kind of other fat burning compounds you like. This is another one where if you pair EGCG with it, the EGCG will not only sensitize your growth hormone receptor to get more of a lipolytic response out of it, but remember what else EGCG does. So, you know, when you look at green tea extract, it actually does a really good job at upregulating the ability of every other fat burning molecule and every other fat burning supplement to work better. So if you're taking caffeines, if you're taking yohimbine, if you're taking anything like that, EGCG is going to make it work better. So I would probably do that. General recommendations for dosages are anywhere from 250 to 500 micrograms. A lot of people, if you use 500 micrograms, it's going to be worth it. Compared to doing the lower dosage, but I've even had some people only use 100 micrograms, but those are more along the lines of my smaller female athletes. Generally, if you can afford the 500, you're going to get a lot of benefit. And this is something that you can use for a fairly long period of time without seeing any desensitization and without seeing any negative side effects. Again, long-term, we don't know the negative side effects that could potentially happen with these, but you know, at least in the short-term, we know that there isn't really anything.
Just for our listeners who don't know what EGC is, it's a green tea polyphenol. So if you're going to buy like a green tea extract, it'll say on the label contains, you know, 45% EGCG. So EGCG is not a peptide or a steroid or anything like that. It's actually a green tea.
Thanks for clarifying that. I probably should have.
Next one in IBC order is, they call it IPA. Ipamorelin, I believe it's pronounced.
Say yeah. That one more time, Steve. The chemistry expert, Steve.
I swear to God, I have like a lisp trying to fucking pronounce these fucking peptides. So tell us a little bit about this one. I just call it IPA on the forum. But I just say IPA. And people
there you go.
IPAM is the short word.
All right, so, I'll go with IPAM. Tell us a little bit about this one.
Yeah, this one's really simple. It falls under the GHRP category. So this is something that you would stack with the GHRH to amplify the pulse that your pituitary actually produces. Now, IPAM is really good because it's the quote-unquote, and I say quote-unquote because I hate saying the word clean, especially because people relate it with clean eating, clean this, clean that. It is the cleanest in terms of experiencing almost zero side effects. So you're not going to have any issues with cortisol. You're not going to have any issues with prolactin. You're going to have no effects on hunger or gastric motility, nothing like that. It is going to give you no negative side effects. But the caveat is, obviously, it's not as strong as some of the other ones. So if you're someone that's very health conscious, then I would basically, this would be the only GHRP that I would recommend. If you're someone that doesn't want to experience anything, if you're new to peptides, if you're just trying this out for the first time, I would do this so you know what a good GHRP should feel like, so you can adjust and know moving forward what these other negative side effects are going to feel like. Because obviously, you know, the benefits are you're going to increase lean mass, you're going to lose body fat, you may have some increased collagen production, obviously improving IGF-1 levels, but the negative side effects, you're going to get fluid retention. You could potentially get carpal tunnel. You are probably going to get lethargic. Another thing to look at with all these peptides is decreasing in insulin sensitivity. You know, that's one thing. Whenever your growth hormone levels go up, insulin sensitivity obviously starts to go down. So with Ipamorelin, it's a really nice introduction into using peptides because you're not going to have that lethargy. You're not going to have that fluid retention. And you'll be able to see on your body the improvements versus if you would use something that might hold a little bit more fluid.
And then the dosage on this one?
Same thing. You're looking at a saturation point of about 100 micrograms. I really wouldn't use any less or any more than that. That seems to work clear across the board for almost everyone.
And then would you recommend stacking that with a CGC?
Yep. Yeah, so you would stack that with another GHRH, mainly being CJC without DAC. So if you would do those together, a very simple one for you guys, you would do Ipamorelin, so 100 micrograms and 100 micrograms of CJC without DAC, you know, first thing upon waking, maybe midday before your lunch meal, and then maybe even before bed again. But you want to make sure you're in the most fasted state possible. And if you really want to get complicated and complex with this, you could do something like after every meal, take, you know, one, two, I use a Humalog, and that'll actually drop your blood sugar levels basically like diabetics do to, you know, to get everything back down. You can get into a fasted state a little bit more quickly. So if you're someone that's taking in a lot of calories and you know that by the time you go to the next meal, your blood sugar levels are still going to be elevated, that could be another option. But if your blood sugar levels are still elevated, you know, by the time you're going to eat your second meal, you'll probably have bigger issues that you should address.
So when you're talking about taking these fasted and then we should be eating after, or take them fasted, work out, then eat after, is that pretty much the system? What happens if a person was to take it fasted, go work out, and then not eat for another 2 or 3 hours? Is that going to be a waste, or is that going to cause like low blood sugar or something?
So you kind of have to look at a cost to benefit ratio, meaning training and nutrition should always be key. We're adding in these things to supplement and to help us get better results from our training and from our nutrition. So I would plan the peptide around how we're doing our current training nutrition and not the other way around. So what I mean by that is you obviously want to be fasted upon injection, upon actually utilizing these peptides. And then as long as you're staying fasted for about 15 to 20 minutes afterward, you know, you're going to ride out that pulse and you're going to get the most benefits from it there. Once you start eating, obviously the effects start to diminish, but a lot of the effects are going to be seen within those first 15 to 20 minutes. Now, if you're using, like, that's one of the reasons why I like utilizing it for fasted cardio, because you wake up, you may take your HGH frag or whatever else you're taking, and then you do cardio for 30 to 45 minutes, you are accelerating lipolysis at such a rapid rate, you're not even thinking about eating. You know, so you're extending that lipolytic window. But then after you're done your cardio, you can eat right away. If you're talking about using it in terms of weight training, I would never want to go into a training session fasted, because the goal year round should be performance. The goal year round should be increasing some kind of progressive overload, progressive volume, something to make you better. Because again, we're bodybuilders, we're strength athletes. It's not trying to see who can get the leanest. It's trying to see who can get the leanest with the most amount of muscle. So if you were going to do that, I would take your growth hormone peptides. Again, you know, about, we'll say you eat your pre-workout meal generally, say 2 hours before your workout. I would probably eat your actual meal, and then 15 minutes before going to your workout, take your peptides. Or if you eat right before you go to the gym, just take them 15 minutes before you eat your meal.
Cool. So the next one, yeah, we already did the M2. I'm not even going to try to pronounce how to pronounce that, because I don't want Trevor making fun of me again. So we're going to go to MGF, which is mechano growth factor. And it's kind of like IGF-1, right?
So I am not a fan of it at all, actually, but go ahead.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about it. Why don't you like it?
So whenever you compare its effects to everything else on the market, it almost doesn't make sense to me why some of these kind of, I don't want to say off-brand peptides, but why there's some of these other kind of, you know, different variations out there. Okay, so if you look at what it does, if you look at how it works, if you look at the end result of what it's trying to do, you can get better results from an MK677 or from a CJC with DAC, or from even an IGF. You know, they're all working through slightly different pathways, but not enough for it to make a difference in this sense. I don't feel like, you know, MGF, I don't even know if people use it anymore, to be honest. I mean, do you guys still hear people using it a lot?
Well, it's sold on our sponsor website. That's why I was asking about it. But I know I don't know anything about it. We don't hear much about it at all in the forums. And then there's a PEG MGF. Is that also you're not a fan of?
Yeah. Those kind of fall into the same category. What's the website, by the way? Because I actually want to see the whole list.
Yeah, it's euro-peptides.net. And that's our board sponsors on Evolutionary Organ Elite Fitness. And I'm using their TB500 right now. And it's awesome.
There you go.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of it. So I'm waiting for them to have the BPC as well in the future. But they always got new stuff coming.
Yeah, I'd be interested if you could ask them what the sales are like on MGF compared to like hexorelin or ipamorelin. I guarantee you the MGF is doing maybe a quarter of what hexorelin or HGF or anything else is doing.
Gotcha. Okay. So the next one, if we continue, how about PALGHK? Is that for collagen or skin? Do you know much about that one?
That one, You know, I've actually haven't looked much into. I read there were a couple studies a while back that I remember reading that showed basically it was causing heart palpitations, and I don't know the correlation. I didn't really research it much after that, to be completely honest.
Okay, and then the last one as we finish is I guess it's a GRF. It's tesamorelin. Is that how you pronounce it?
Say it one more time. I didn't hear you.
Yeah. I'm sorry. It's a tesamorelin.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
So,
go ahead.
Yeah. So if you look at this, this is really good at actually, and I actually like using it for its cognitive benefits. So if you look at this, it's kind of a, so it is a stabilized analog of the growth hormone releasing factor. So GHRF that actually induces growth hormone in, you know, obviously the way that it's meant to. I like it because there was one study, they had something like 80, it was basically a study in the elderly. I can't remember all of the details with it, but I remember in terms of cognition, things were boosted something like 50 to 60% from a cognitive standpoint. You look a little bit more, you look at how it works, you look at why people would use it, and it makes sense that from a neurological standpoint, it has more beneficial effects on the brain than I would say any other kind of peptide out there. There is some out there in terms of, there's some benefit out there in terms of it, including it actually accelerates fat waste. So it decelerates fat accumulation as well. I don't really see that to be the case. I've had people use it, and the only thing I see people actually benefit from is from a mental standpoint. So that's kind of another one where I really don't have a lot of people use it, because if you're looking at increasing cognition, I just feel like you're better off with going with a traditional nootropic like a alpha GPC or, you know, something like that.
So I know Trevor has user questions, but this is my last one to you. Healing Stack. What are two or maybe three that you'd recommend in a healing stack? And what are two or three that you'd recommend in a fat loss stack, et cetera, that are your personal favorites?
Okay. So healing stack, we're talking about joints, right?
Whatever you describe healing. I mean, some guys have, you know, some guys could have joints. Some guys should have nagging injuries. Just.
Okay. Perfect then. So the traditional stack, and I've talked about this many times on my Instagram and podcasts and videos and all that fun stuff. That's the traditional TP500 and then BPC-157. Like we talked about before, they both do go systemic, but BPC works a little bit better, closer to the actual injured site. Now, we covered TP500, but just so you guys remember, you're looking at about, it was what, 0.0383 mgs per 1 pound of body weight. Okay, so a lot of people are going to fall between that 180 to 200 pound range. So you're looking about maybe 5 to 10 milligrams, split twice weekly, run for about 4 to 6 weeks. You want to pair that with BPC-157. Now that is one that does a really good job at actually increasing the healing rates of muscle tears. It helps with bone to tendon healing. It helps with a lot of beneficial effects. Actually, there's been some studies actually looking at its healing of ulcers in the stomach. But it's funny, whenever it was taken orally, it actually didn't work at all. It actually completely destroyed the product. So it's definitely something that you have to take subcutaneously, like all these other peptides. You're generally looking at about, it's like 1 to 10 micrograms per kilogram of body weight. So that breaks down to a lot of people falling that 200 to 600 micrograms per day. And remember, that's daily. That's not with TP500. TP500 is 2 times per week, whereas BPC-157 is every day. So if you have sore elbows, obviously you want to pull up that little, you know, fatty puff of skin around your elbow, and right about there is where you actually want to apply it. I would say that is the best healing stack out there. If I could add a third one in there that's still technically a peptide, it would obviously be exogenous growth hormone. I've had people utilize that stack of those three products, you know, recover from rotator cuff tears, torn pecs, and, you know, sometimes less than half the time that it would have normally taken. So they obviously hold a lot of benefit. In terms of, we'll say an actual growth stack, so trying to put on more muscle as fast as possible, I would really go with, can I add MK677 to this?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, even though it's a secretagogue, usually it's fallen under the same category. I would have MK677 and CJC with DAC. So with this, and let me make sure I explain it, you obviously need to be very careful with how your blood sugars are being raised and elevated, because these are two products that work 24/7 to be basically having constantly releasing pulses of growth hormone. Okay, so you have NK677 that releases multiple pulses throughout the day. Then you have that baseline, basically that quote-unquote bleeding effect or baseline effect of the CJC with DAC. So dosage-wise with that, I would start low with something like 12.5 milligrams for MK and maybe 2 milligrams of CJC with DAC. Again, taken with a pretty decent somatostatin inhibitor. And that would probably get you very far. You can run that for a couple weeks. You can see a lot of growth. That's definitely something you don't want to take a lot of right away, because you are going to experience a lot of fluid retention if you were to start off MK at the traditional 25 milligrams and CJC at like 5 milligrams. So definitely be careful with that. But that's I've seen people get their IGF scores, like I said, up into the 500 to 700 range, which is extremely tremendous for peptides. And that obviously correlates with putting them in the best position possible to grow. So I've had a lot of people put on some good size with that combo. In terms of fat loss, I would have to say if we did something like if we stuck with HGH frag and ipamorelin, so the way I would do that would be HGH frag plus ipamorelin first thing upon waking with, like I talked about, an actual somatostatin inhibitor. This one, I would actually prefer nicotine gum. So nicotine gum actually does a really good job at actually enhancing lipolysis. It actually activates, different types of fat tissue to actually accelerate fat loss from that aspect. And it obviously does a great job at inhibiting somatostatin. Midday, I would only go with the ipamorelin, again, another about a milligram of nicotine gum. And then before bed, I would go back to the HGH frag and ipamorelin with, again, about another milligram of nicotine gum. Now, that stack will get you to lose body fat extremely fast. Issue is you need to keep a very close eye on if you're someone that can be, I don't want to say habitual, but addicted to nicotine gum. If you're sticking to 1 milligram, you shouldn't have any issues. Some people feel like it's taking it too far. I've just seen way too many good results with that combination of those, things right there to really not mention it. So that'd probably be the best way that you could set up a recomp or a fat loss stack. The reason why ipamorelin is in there and something like hexorelin isn't is just because you're not going to be having a lot of any of the fluid retention with ipamorelin. So if you're trying to lose fat, I would prefer not to see a lot of fluids. You can see if you're actually losing a lot of body fat or what's fat, what's fluid, and what do you actually have on your body. But you could do that a couple of different ways. As long as that HGH frag is in there, you're going to get a lot of benefit.
So you said you would use the HGH frag with hexorelin and a somatostatin inhibitor. What would you recommend for that?
Say it one more time.
So when you said that in the morning before cardio, you recommend the HGH frag, hexorelin, and a somatostatin inhibitor. What would you recommend for the somatostatin inhibitor?
So for that one, I would still, if you're looking to, okay, so let me actually back up and talk about somatostatin inhibitors. Whenever you look at them, obviously, you're using that because whenever somatostatin is released, and I could be saying that word wrong, essentially what it can do is obviously blunt any effects of growth hormone being present. Now, there's a lot of people that will say that they're bullshit. These ones don't have any, backing in terms of the literature, but you can tell whenever you actually apply it. If you would do a basic peptide, you have no chance of knowing if somatostatin is going to be raised. So you're putting this in there to actually inhibit it, to make sure that you're getting the most bang for your buck and to make sure that you're actually getting the benefits of these peptides. So whenever you're looking at these different somatostatin inhibitors, you're looking at things like huperzine A, which is probably my least favorite, EGCG, nicotine, melatonin, horny goat weed. And there's a lot of other different derivatives out there that I really don't like, but those are my favorite ones. So if we're looking at it from that aspect, I would use the somatostatin inhibitor that's correlated with my goal within the next couple hours. So if your goal is to enhance fat loss over the next couple hours and be more lipolytic, then I'd look at nicotine gum. If you're trying to grow, for example, and put on more muscle tissue, I would probably use EGCG. And EGCG can be used in either circumstance, actually. That's something I might keep in as a constant. If you're someone who's taking it before bed with, say, MK677, that's when I would throw in something like melatonin, because that obviously plays very well and can get you into a deeper REM sleep, increase hyperplasia, sensitize growth hormone receptors, all that kind of good stuff. So I would really pair it based off of what your goal is within the next couple hours.
Nicotine gum is very, very effective. Also in a pre-contest scenario, it's really good for helping cut appetite, but it can cause insomnia. So be careful about using nicotine gum, you know, after about 7 or 8 p.m.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that because someone else, with someone to do it out there, they're like, God damn, Alex told me to take this and I'm up all night.
So we got this will be our last listener question we have time for. So Chad Mack asks, I'd like to know if there are any natural anti-prolactin or natural anti-cortisol supplements or diet besides Caber and Prani that I could use while on Hexarelin. I ran test NPP recently with Justin AI and Proviron and had no issues. Or are these anti-prolactin and anti-cortisol supps even needed with Hexarelin?
I would honestly say they're not needed. Whenever you look at a lot of people that say would use Caber, for example, if you are controlling estrogen levels, you're not going to need to control prolactin. That's one of the biggest things that I don't like seeing out there whenever you see a lot of people using cabergoline, whenever, if they could really get a handle of their estrogen levels. And remember, there's about 16 different kinds of estrogen. So whenever you're getting your blood work done, you can't just always rely on your basic estradiol, because that could come back fine, but you may get it back and one of the other ones are going to be out of range, and that could be causing your issue. So I would really get a close eye on your estrogen and learn how to control that and learn basically what causes it to be elevated and what causes some of the prolactin side effects to become apparent or to even raise prolactin indirectly.
Steve, you have any more questions?
Guys, we had Alex before. He's a young guy. I think you said you're in mid-late 20s. He is, for his age, he is probably the smartest guy I've ever seen. This guy, for him to know all this stuff off the top of his head is amazing, guys. So please check out his Instagram. Check out his social media. If you need a coach, if you need some knowledge, definitely hit this guy up. He knows his stuff. He's a very humble and smart guy. And we thank him for coming on the show and educating us about these peptides.
I appreciate that, man. You guys are too kind, making me blush.
The easiest way to get a hold of Alex is just theprepcoach.com. If you go on that website, his website looks like crap, and I've broken his balls about this before. Very effective, and has links to his YouTube. Well, I guess his YouTube account actually got taken down, but has links to his Instagram, his podcast, his Facebook, his coaching services, his links to everything.
Yep, exactly. And I actually talked with the guy you recommended me to, so in the process of making that website better.
Oh, okay. You got to hold my IT guy.
Yep.
Okay, good. So in a couple months, if you're listening to this episode, a couple months after we recorded it, Alex's website is no longer going to look like a five-year-old made it for him. So Alex, we really appreciate you coming on the show. For your host, Trevor Caritzen, for my co-host, Steve Smeet, and for our special guest, Alex Kickle, owner of theprepcoach.com. This has been another episode of Evolutionary Radio. Live your life, look good doing it. Thanks for listening.
Mm-hmm.